This public lecture, given in Auckland on the 10th of September 1974, is by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson. The title, How the Limitations of Etheric, Astral and Mental Consciousness May Be Transcended. This is the 9th in the series of lectures given by Mr. Hodgson.
Mr. Eden and friends, appropriate to our subject, in the Leyland Stanford University at Palo Alto, California, there is written for all the students to see under a mural in the chapel. And I took a note of it, and here are the words. There is no narrowing so deadly as the narrowing of man's horizon of spiritual things. No worse evil could befall him in his course on earth than to lose sight of heaven. And it is no civilization that can compensate for it. No widening of science, no possession of abstract truth can indemnify for an enfeebled hold on the highest and central truths of humanity. And it closes with this question: what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Someone else has written these words: he who truly wakes to the impermanence and contradiction of the world is, for the first time, really awake. But the one who cannot, in daily life, see the self which is his true nature, whose interests are vulgar crazes and the things of the world, whose thought never leaves the circle of gossip and public opinion, whose desires are just for empirical happiness, material things, fame and gain, where is his true nature? In the viciousness called the world, he has buried it. He has entombed the soul. Wonderfully put, I suggest. How does theosophy help us to approach this important subject? Well, we find there the affirmation that man, each one of us, has a second self, untouched by time, unsullied by events and worldly experiences. And theosophy states that this is the eternal man, the real, deeper, spiritual essence, the egoic individuality, or if we like, the spirit in man, which is forever one with, yes, identical with, the spirit of the universe. And so it is taught in theosophy, throughout the wisdom of the ages, in fact, that universal spirit is focused into individuality in man. And this is the true self, the spiritual soul, and man's source of power and wisdom and intelligence. Furthermore, it is taught that this spiritual self of each one of us is immortal, undying. invulnerable, indestructible. Further, we learn that this interior self has a vesture of light within which it is enrobed, as it were. The Greeks called it the orgoides, the self-radiant divine fragment. And this inner self, thus robed, is undergoing a process of evolution by means of successive lives here on earth in physical bodies, all experiences being decided by law or action and reaction. The goal to which the spiritual self of each one of us is thus evolving is adeptship, or as St. Paul put it, the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, to become an occult sage. On the way thereto, it is also taught that experience of and within this true spiritual self is obtainable and very, very helpful when attained. And this evening, for the most part, we are going to look together at the teachings concerning some of the results, some of the experience of spiritual awareness, or, if we like, in theosophical terms, causal consciousness. Awareness, at least at the level of the abstract intelligence. It is also taught that there are stages of advancement towards this experience of enlightenment, to that knowledge which, as Walt Whitman put it, the knowledge that passes all the argument of the earth, the inner illumination by which we can ultimately see things as they are, beholding all creation, the animals, the angelic hosts, the plants, and the figures of our friends, and all the ranks and races of humankind, see them in their true order and being. Edward Carpenter. Among the many experiences it is discovered, to which the illumined ones have borne testimony, are these: the experience, as I shall be saying later, when I go to details a little, of what is called the subjective light, of finding oneself in one's true nature, not this bodily person, in one's true interior nature, as a center of radiance, shining out into a world of light. One of the first experiences. Nearly every mystic, as you will remember, refers thus to their experience. With it comes a moral elevation, also an intellectual illumination, and there comes then a sense of being immortal, so that they lose, these mystics, they lose the fear of death. It fades out. They also lose, it is reported, the sense of sin, as if the previous character of the man, intellectual, moral, and physical, were in some way transcended. And this is a suddenness, an instantaneousness of awakening. Nearly all report this instantaneity of the experience. There appear to be certain periods in human life, certain years, shall I say, when this is most likely to happen. From 28 to about 32 is very favorable, shall we say, though it can happen at any time. Even children have entered into it. When it does come, there is a certain added charm to the personality, and those who meet them can be strongly attracted to the illumined person. And sometimes, I think I've seen this in one other or two at least, there does occur a transfiguration of the subject's appearance. And this can become noticeable to others, particularly when this cosmic sense is active. Or, as it is said, you remember of Moses, when he came down from the mount, having received the Ten Commandments. It says in the Bible, he knew not that his face did shine. What else? Well, as we'll see a little later, the sense of I-ness is reduced to a minimum, and a feeling of having received spiritual grace, somewhat as on receiving Holy Communion. Some of the mystics testify that they found themselves suddenly and without warning with a sense of being immersed in flame or a rose-colored cloud. Or, yes, some, that the mind is itself filled with a cloud of radiant light. And then at the same time, some have said that they became bathed in emotion, an emotion of joy, assurance, triumph, salvation. And along with moral elevation and intellectual illumination comes what must be called, for want of a better term, a sense of immortality. The fear of death, as I've just said, which hurts and haunts so many people at times in their lives, falls off like an old cloak, should we say. Not, by the by, not as a result of reasoning or study, but the fear of death simply vanishes to come back no more. And the same, yes, the same may be said of sin and remorse. It isn't apparently that the person escapes from sin, but he no longer sees that there is any sin in the world from which to escape. The whole outlook apparently is changed. But throughout all this, one learns, reading many accounts, fruitful occupation by the by, the instantaneousness of the illumination is one of its striking features. It can be compared with nothing so well as a dazzling light, like a flash of lightning in a dark night. Omar Khayyam expresses this contrast. The worldly hope that men did set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone. contrast with this dazzling illumination which endures. Now, how may we approach, seek for, and understand such possible experiences, which doubtless some of you have known? What do the teachers say? Well, that causal consciousness or spiritual awareness is not a condition to be reached by reasoning. It often defies all intellectual determination. And that is why, I suppose, those who have experienced it are frequently at a loss to explain it coherently or logically. When it is explained, it loses its content more and more, as if the whole experience undergoes a kind of mutilation. Someone has written that the cosmic sense is characterized by incommunicability. And so, it must be concluded that spiritual awareness is an inner perception which takes place in the most interior part of human nature, and for the most part is far beyond man's discursive understanding. You can't organize, you can't argue about it. You can't reason very much about it. And you couldn't organize it into any kind of a system. If you do, you destroy it. Or reduce it tremendously. So that as long as one's observation is limited to those conditions of the formal mind which preceded causal consciousness, then that cannot be fully comprehended. Which reminds me of a story. Strange one. The devil, yes. The devil, if such a being there be, which there isn't. The devil in this story was walking along the road with a human friend. And the devil said to his friend, he said, "I had an extraordinary experience today." "Oh," said the human friend, "what was it?" "Well," he said, "a very transcendent and wonderful being came to me and said that we are planning to give great truth to the world almost immediately." "Oh," said his friend, "that's not very good news for you, is it?" "Oh, I don't know," he said. "Well," said his friend, "what are you going to do about it when this great truth is to deliver to mankind? What will you do?" He said, "I shall let them organize it." Now let us penetrate a little more deeply still from those generalities. Come with me then, supposing we had this experience, what would we find? Be prepared for strange and even incomprehensible descriptions. Try and listen with intuitive wisdom, won't you? For example, in causal consciousness, there is an entire absence of negatives. There's no fear, no place, no possibility of fear. Or of need, or of want, or of loneliness. Impossible, can't enter the consciousness. They're all negatives, you see. Only positives exist there. and all the contradictions and disturbances caused by the intellect are all harmonized in a unity of a higher order, so that it's found that truth which is beyond and above affirmation, denial, argument, or organizing it. So, it is stated that causal consciousness, and remember we're all in possession of this, this is where we live, and we live in this. And once we find ourselves, our real selves, this will be the experience. Causal consciousness indivisible into such oppositions as good and evil, eternal and temporal, material and spiritual. All opposites and all contradictions are united and harmonized into a consistent organic whole in spiritual awareness. Only positives can exist at such high frequencies. The inner self is beyond the sway of opposites. Every two, if you like, if I could put it that way, every two is one, as at the apex of a triangle, where exists the original inseparability, a great oneness, balanced equipoise. Follow me. Infinite withinness and withoutness. And there's little or no sense of embodiment for the orgoides or vehicle or vesture of light in which the inner self is enrobed. It doesn't have a skin. It's edgeless, should I say. It's skinless, and the consciousness there is universal. The sense of I-ness is greatly reduced, and it vanishes as you go deeper and deeper into yourself. Things vanish, as is taught in Zen Buddhism. No thingness, no objects. Or should I say, causal consciousness is objectless. That's what we're trying to do now, to engage in objectless thought. The ego abides not in thinking awareness, but in unconscious or thought-free awareness. Dynamic intuition, if you like, free of any mental process. If you look around, there's nothing about, no one about, yet consciousness is rich, full. Absence of fear implies courage, but neither can exist in cosmic consciousness. It's beyond, yes, egoic consciousness is beyond the restrictions of rationality. Listen, friends, and listen meditatively with me. Light in light is reported by most of those who have thus entered and discovered their inner selves, of being a center of radiance in a sea of light. Yes, curiously, I don't want to make a pun, but there's also there's a state of mental enlightenment, such as comes on the sudden solution of a problem, hitherto insoluble, sometimes called a moment of truth. Yes, that's typical. You don't reason your way to the central reality. You're there all the time, and when you turn to it, you know it all in a moment of truth. It's like picking a hidden lock. The flood of new experiences gushes forth from the opening. Or if you like, yes, not quite true, but helpful, I hope. It's like when the clock striking the hours. When the appointed time comes, there's a click. And the whole percussion of sounds is released. Now the mind seems to have something of this mechanism. And when a certain moment is reached, a hitherto closed screen, should I say, is lifted. An entirely new vista opens up to consciousness. And the tone of one's whole life processes are changed thereafter. Yes, life is never the same thereafter. So spiritual awareness implies the elevation of one's intellectual and spiritual powers to the very highest degree. And all the great utterances, all the great poetic and scriptural sayings so full of wonder, they've all come from this elevation. They're overflowings of a soul filled with deep experiences. Or it can be put, if you like, from this level come those flashes of intuition. Correct premonitions, like bolts from the blue, you suddenly know. And they are drawn from this aspect of egoic consciousness, which contains the archetypal idea. All the archetypal ideas. Basic fundamentals, do you see, on which the universe is established. And these shine in light and color in the inner world. And sometimes they send their reflections into the mortal mind with an extraordinary sense of certainty. So that we say, don't we, sometimes, I know in my bones. It's like that. The experience is described by some of having realized oneself also as a center of power, immeasurable power. Like, yes, this is not a good analogy, like pouring oil on a blazing fire. The fire of genius within man. But yes, I must say this, but nevertheless, it's gentle. It's quite gentle. However, fiery the power. And with all this, also, and perhaps in another focus, freedom. Freedom from all possible restrictions, mental, emotional, physical. Fear of death is gone. There is no mechanism at all to operate. There's an absolute inherent trust in life. It's no question of making choices. Only spontaneous, motive-free existence. No planning in advance. No action. And freedom from these is like when a difficult mathematical problem is solved, or when a discovery is made, or when a sudden means of escape is realized in the midst of the most desperate complications. Or, with Archimedes, one explains, Eureka! Though that's spoiling it rather, bringing it down to the mind and to words. the inner self of each one of us in its own nature, in its own world, abides in serenity, based on unarguable certainty, upon absolute self-assurance, which is selfless. In this aspect, the inner self is always mystically serene and perfectly quiet, tranquil, still. Sometimes, in meditation, that stillness, that tranquility, may be known. Stillness, the mind becomes enfolded in stillness, as if it had become absorbed in its source, and the whole being, if only for a moment, but prolonged ideally, is quiet, serene, silent. And might I say to you there, breaking in personally a moment, if in meditation that touch of silence comes, don't disturb it. Don't continue whatever progression has been laid down or ordained in yoga. Don't do that. This is the precious experience. Yoga might indeed be described as the science of stillness. Means that there's a touch, do you see, with this aspect of the egoic consciousness, wherein the inner self is always mystically serene, perfectly quiet. And then again, of course, naturally, the time sense is completely changed. At the causal level, our succession of past, present, and future becomes apparently merged in what is called duration, which is described as time without limits. Perhaps we can get something of it. Now think of this meeting. An hour or two ago, we began to prepare. And then eventually we had to make plans to travel and arrive and get here, and we take our seats, and here we are, and the meeting is here, and it's now going on in duration, you see. And it will go on. Well, now, the whole of life for the inner self is free of the exact definitions and divisions of past, present, and future. Time, if I dare say, time in wholeness. For the ego, for example, there are no past lives. Why not? Well, because it's never lost consciousness. All is, yes, dare I say this, it abides in a time continuum, always, doesn't stop, ever, in a sense of eternity. True, there are the mind, emotion, vehicles, they have their periods of limitation down here, but the ego doesn't, not at all. It's all going on all the time. And what for us were our lives in, say, Atlantis, and Egypt and Greece and the East and the Far East and the Middle Ages and here and now we are. These to us, in these limited brain minds, these are separated experiences, not to the ego. It's rather like, suddenly occurs to me, if you have a light which stays lit, you can completely cover it so that it can't be seen. But the light's still there, and you take it off, it's still there, just the same. You can cover it again, next life, take it out. It hasn't affected the life in the sense of its existence. So past lives are now continuing. In fact, yes, I dare to say, it's only now in causal consciousness. There isn't such a thing as... You can't think of past, present and future. There isn't such a concept at all. There's only now. One moment. This one. Which mystics trying to describe it call the absolute moment. Or as one I read the other day, the sacramental moment. Now, in our inner selves, we abide there in the eternal now. And as you proceed with your yoga regularly, or prayer, or whatever the method, and when you touch the inner self, and it touches you, as it's waiting to do, then these are the experiences which follow immediately. Yes, and the same way, carry it a little further, space limitations vanish. There isn't somewhere else, over there somewhere, there isn't an over there. All is here and all is now. And there's no, from the beginning, there's no such thing as movement. No distance in causal consciousness. No measurement. All is here. Or as some very wonderfully clever mystic has put it, the adjacence of everything, everywhere. Adjacence, of course, means touching. It's not true, it doesn't go, but it helps a bit. All is one. All beings are as one. I was thinking then of that story of the Lord Sri Krishna, who allegorically and wholly symbolically is said to have been married to hundreds of women, symbols of the soul of man, of course, to which the eternal spirit is forever wedded, because within. And the story, as I remember it, is that a man came into the presence of the Lord and said, Oh great Lord, I understand you have a great many wives. I can't find any wife for myself. Would it be possible, O Lord, that I could have one of yours? So the Lord said, Of course you can. You may go into the houses of all my wives. And in any house in which you don't find me, you may have that wife. And of course, wherever he went, there was the radiant figure of the Lord. House symbolizes the personality. Nonsense down here, I know, down here in our brains. So valuable to reach up to that realm where all is one and all beings are one. like another story in which two men were talking. And one said to the other, "Have you ever been snubbed?" "Often," he said. "Didn't matter." "Why not?" "Because I was never there." So the inner self of each one of us abides, as some of you doubtless know, in the calm, higher moments of meditation and study, in unity, identity, non-distinction. In Zen, no thing. Here, of course, we're imprisoned because we live with things, you see. Everywhere we look, there's a thing. It's difficult to imagine a state of consciousness where there are no things. But the moment you escape free from the prison of the formal mind, you're in that condition where there are no things. And the deeper you go and the deeper you go, there is nothing at all. No thing. No thing. Only in the sense of thing, as we know it here, as Madame Blavatsky says, the void is really a fullness. Fullness. Do you remember that other story from Zen Buddhism? When the fifth patriarch of one of the temples of Zen Buddhism in China was going to die, as he knew, he had to look for his successor. So he asked the monks, any monk who aspired to the office, to write on the wall
a sutra
on the wall. And so one monk, can you remember it, dear? One of the monks wrote a sutra on the wall.
My body is the Bodhi tree.
My body is the Bodhi tree.
My mind a mirror bright.
My mind a mirror bright.
Hourly, daily and hourly, I polish it.
Daily and hourly, I polish it.
So that no dust alight.
And of course, that was hopeless. He was still in the realm of things. See, he didn't get anywhere. But there was a man, not a monk at all, who worked out in the yard, a kind of rastabout. And he heard about this, so he came in. And he asked one of the monks if he might be allowed to write his
sutra,
which means a verse. He couldn't write because he was totally illiterate. But he got the monk to write his sutra for him. Can you, dear?
There is no Bodhi tree.
There is no Bodhi tree.
Nor stand of mirror bright.
Nor stand of mirror bright.
When all is void, where can the dust alight?
Since all is void, where can the dust alight? See the difference from things to no thing. Void, yes. Empty, yes. But a fullness in reality. I know that's a contradiction down here. Then that's the weakness and limitations of the formal mind. And in causal consciousness, which we've been thinking about together, that is transcended. And all its limitations, arguments, and thingness, if I might so term, that vanishes. There aren't any. There aren't anything. And all this occurs in a kind of experience of unity, of identity, of non-distinction, which somebody has called not thingness, but suchness. And in addition, a restful stillness pervades consciousness as this condition is entered. And at times, as I've just been saying, this descends upon the mind and the meditating yogi. And it's in that stillness that a self-declaration of the spirit occurs. The individual knows, not in any argumentative sense, just knows. It's gained, closing now, it's gained, of course, by the regular practice of contemplation of the divine, of allowing all the sheer personality-ness and thing-ness of one's normal waking state to fade out in quietude, tranquility, stillness. This gives the inner self a chance, an opportunity, which otherwise can't really take because there's too much going on, do you see? The phone's always in use, the number's always engaged, do you see? So the process of ringing up the ego on the telephone and the ego replying can't be fulfilled, you see. And that's what yoga is really, you know, friends. It's a ringing up of this spiritual self, mentally. You have to know its number, of course, and the language which it speaks in, which is no words at all, but instant illumination. Dazzling light. Here I close with some phrases on which to think. Deep in meditation we are. We can say these things mentally, seeking to pass into the vivid experience. I am rooted in the eternal. I am immortal, self-shining, pure being. Wonderful one. I am immortal, self-shining, pure being. And with our Lord, I and my Father are one. The self which I am is one with the self in all. And I close with a Kabbalist prayer directed to this end. Universal God, one life, one light, one power. Thou all in all, beyond expression, beyond comprehension. O nature, thou something from no thing, thou symbol of wisdom. In myself, I am nothing. In thee, I am I. I live in thee. Live thou in me. And bring me out of the region of self into the eternal light. Amen. Such, friends, is a very limited and too short attempted exposition of the wonder of wonders. That the real, eternal individuality of each one of us, of every being, is forever united with the eternal individuality of the universe as a whole. Not two, one. Thank you.